Daniel Adekwai.
Here.
Amira Aftab. Sonia Agarwal. Jay Anand. Lydia Bloom. Dylan Carson. Maishay Kazi. Admir Cekic. Colton Cook. Zora Duran. Grace Dorward. Max Ehrlich.
Here.
Armand Fard.
Things. The meeting minutes from April 9th. No. Oh, damn.
Christian Flournoy.
Are you sure we don't have it? Are you sure we don't have it? The meeting minute?
Are they spots?
I don't know.
They're on the market.
Ezra Galperin.
Present.
Isabella Gale. Lawrence Hahn. Vansh Kakra. Seon Kim. Catherine Christopa. Amelia Lyons. Yasmin Massoud. Ellie Porter.
Cool.
John Purcell. Hayden Spector.
Present.
Jocelyn Suave. Christian Tarala. Thor Wagspack. Alexander Walters. Hayden Watkins. Zachary Yabut. Eric Yao, Kennedy Young,
Cornell University is located on the traditional ha homelands of the Gayan-Hono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayan-Hono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedences the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of the Gayan-Ono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of the Gayan-Ono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. We currently do not have meeting minutes, so we now move to the fourth agenda, which is the consent calendar. For those of you who don't know, consent calendars are not debated on, but I will describe what's within this consent calendar. Resolution 83, approving disbursement of airport shuttles. And the consent calendar is non-debatable and must be considered as a whole. If there is no dissent, the consent calendar is adopted, and Resolution 83 is approved on third reading. So, any dissent? Hearing no dissent, Resolution 83 is now approved. We will now move to reports of officers. It's in consent calendar, so there's no debate. And with no dissent, it's assumed. Yes.
Can I just say, like, I don't think we even got sent an agenda by email, so, like, a lot of people haven't heard about it. Can we, like, read this? Like, I think it will pass. Can we, like, read it?
You would have to do a motion to remove the resolution from the consent calendar so we could consider it as every other resolution, but consent calendars cannot be debated.
I looked at it. I'm fine with it passing.
Without any formal motions, we will continue to move to reports of officers, committees, and liaisons. Those who wish to speak, please raise your placards now. Representative Galperin.
It's that time of the month, guys. Dining committee will be meeting on Monday at Cookhouse, where we will continue to discuss options, dining options for Equity Engagement Community and the Veterans House, as well as our reusable cup proposal. By the way, if anyone has amendments to those resolutions, feel free to offer them. Like, it's okay. All are welcome. And it's free food, even if you don't have a meal plan.
Representative Director Gillison, sorry.
It's not on the bill.
Check the button. Yeah, I think they're off. Yeah.
The student assembly election voting will be on Monday. There's a current time on the website. We're hoping to hit that time. Historically, there are sometimes delays and things like that. We will adjust by whatever time the emails go out to all the students. There will then be whatever, like 7 days of voting starting right after. Regardless, we hope to open them on Monday, which has always been the plan. But yeah, voting will start on Monday. So please, if you are running, keep that in mind. Keep up campaigning. And starting on Monday, you will be allowed to tell people as you're campaigning, hey, now you can go in your email, open up the OPA vote link, and then go and vote. In addition, the candidate profiles are now live on the Student Assembly website. It is broken up by, sorry, Jay's distracting me. It is broken up by race. So if you want to see your own profile, click on your race, and then it will your student assembly race, and you will be able to you will be able to see your profile. If anyone has any questions about that, please let me or Eric know. An important distinction: Eric deals with all IT issues, so I'm happy to direct any questions to Eric. IT stuff, anything about the website should really go to him, like just as a starting point. I'm a rules guy, as I've said. So there you go.
You Representative Ferraro.
Yeah, I don't know. As we go into election season, I just wanted to remind everyone to that during this time we should be, acting with decorum and all that. I've seen plenty of stuff on SideChat already. Let's just be civil about things and remind other your friends to similarly act similarly. Yeah, at this point, the International Students Committee, we never had enough members or the required members to run. We needed three student assembly members to join. So I'm just gonna, this is my last time I'm gonna talk about it for the semester, as we will not be meeting, letting you guys know that.
Representative Watkins. Oh, Vice President Watkins. Walters.
Hello, everyone. For those of you who are candidates, you saw my email about a Meet the Candidates event. That's something that I'm hoping to host either Monday or Wednesday. The when to meet seems the when to meet says that those are probably the best times for people. So people who aren't running for re-election are also, of course, welcome to come and just talk about what's happening on Assembly. Everyone should have gotten the email about the Assembly roundup and the Google form to submit it. And I also sent a mock version. So there are literally zero excuses for you to not submit your assembly roundup. Those are due April 27th, which is also the final day of the voting period. Please just submit them. I'm going to send a reminder email over the listserv tonight. If you need help or anything, let me know. We can talk about that later. And then, I left over by the agendas. I put a couple models of the flyers that we're wanting to put up to get the vote out, to get the word out about elections. If you have any notes or any ideas, also let me know. Super open to that. Yeah.
Represent yes, Representative Director Gillison.
Sorry, I just want to give a huge shout out to Alex for all the work he's done on this. Typically, the Elections Committee has both had to serve as the logistics and rules end of the election, as well as the marketing team. But because of Alex's efforts, we now can just focus on the rules and logistics. So thank you so much. And yeah, please attend those events. Obviously, know that the rules still apply. Even if I'm not physically there, people can still object to you. But these are events for you to meet other candidates, meet constituents. So please take advantage of every opportunity, because my goal is both a free and fair election, but also one where many people vote. So please keep that in mind, and good luck to everyone.
Representative Bloom.
Hi guys. Environmental Committee is most likely going to meet this Sunday, 5 to 6. We haven't had a meeting for a couple weeks, but looking forward to this one. And then Wednesday the 22nd is Earth Day, if you're not already aware. We got approved for around 5 to 7 tables in Ho Plaza from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. So we're going to have some environmental orgs come table, including Plastic Free Cornell, who we heard from, and a couple others. If you know any orgs that would be interested, let me know. Or if you're interested yourself, also let me know. Yeah, I think that's pretty much what's happening with us. So,
Representative Carson.
Sign. Oh,
any further comments or questions? Seeing none, and the fact that we have no announcements, we will move to the presentation portion of our agenda. Today, we are joined by Dean Love and Dean Dunifon. I hope I didn't mispronounce that. Here to present the Sexual Assault Prevention Task Force. Please welcome them in with lots of welcome.
I think none of the mics are on. Just on the bottom, you can turn it on, guys.
Dean, this is not working.
It's on. It's on. No, I just heard you through the speaker.
They can do it. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
They're both working now. Yeah, it's working.
I'm the Dean of the College of Human Ecology. And Dean Love and I are here to talk with you about the work that we've been doing for a little over a year on the Presidential Task Force on Sexual Assault. And we don't have a lot of time and we mostly want to really hear from you. And so we're going to go through our slides pretty quickly, assuming that you've already been informed about it. You've read the report. It's on the website. There's been a lot of coverage of it. And we really want to have a conversation with you. So next slide. So just to remind people what our charge was, we want to emphasize that we were focusing on undergraduate students on the Ithaca campus, that our goal was to take a holistic framework approach and think about the entire campus culture and community, and that's where you all come in. Similar way to think about it is we're taking a public health approach, thinking broadly about intervention and responses, and that we want to focus on prevention and the social conditions in which assaults occur.
And so really our goal is cultural and institutional change at Cornell. Many pieces of sort of a public health approach is looking at people, culture, policy, institutional structures that lead to an environment that in this case fosters sexual health and safety. Next slide.
So,
no, that's you.
So I want to start by just sharing some data. So Cornell is fortunate in that we have a high quality survey that's been distributed every other year since 2015. And our committee relied on that data for many aspects of our report. This is what the data tells us, and it's highly concerning and hard to see. What we see is that the percentage of undergraduate women who say that they've experienced sexual assault during their time at Cornell during the most recent survey was about 35%. In other years, it was more around 24%. We do note we had a relatively low response rate in the 2025 survey, but the numbers have been adjusted to account for that. Around for men, about 9 or 10% of men given the year report having experienced a sexual assault during their time at Cornell. Next slide. The data tell us that experiences of sexual assault are about twice as high for women who are part of the Greek system. The data also tell us that the most common location for sexual assault is residence halls, followed by off-campus residences and fraternity houses. Next slide. This information talks about what type of assault is most common. So for women, about 42% of the assaults involve penetration or attempted penetration. In the vast majority of cases, the perpetrator was a fellow student. The data also tell us that it's quite rare for people to say report that they've contacted a resource after experiencing an assault. And you can see here some of the reasons that people indicated that they didn't do that. But 80% told a friend, and that I think really speaks to the importance of this community-focused public health type approach. And then finally, the data really emphasize the prevalent role of alcohol. So in the majority of assaults, the perpetrator drank. And also in the majority, the victim drank. And for women, almost three quarters were incapacitated or passed out, or a smaller percentage were passed out during those assaults. So throughout our recommendations, there's a focus on the role of alcohol in this.
Before I talk a little bit about our process, we wanted to talk, we don't have a slide here, but we wanted to share that the framework for our process, the framework that we used was from a really great book, and I would encourage folks to read it, called Sexual Citizens, and it really looks at sexual assault on college campuses. It's a multi-year, multi-mode study of Columbia University and ethnographic work, following students around campus, talking with them, finding out about their routine, looking at residence halls and off-campus spaces. And really, it identifies sort of three main concepts that we have used to guide our work, and that will help us help me talk a little bit about the process. Sexual citizenship, sexual geographies, and sexual projects. And really, this is looking at the ways in which people identify sort of what people want to do sexually with each other and honor that and affirm and respect that. And so that would really be a sexual project. What is it that I'm hoping to gain out of the moments where I'm engaging in sexual contact or sexual relationships, and why I do it, when I want to do it, why I want to do it, and that being respected. And then the other is sort of how space and place shape and also create sort of power structures that enable sort of the other two, sexual citizenship and sexual projects to be enacted. And so I really encourage you to read the book. It's by Hersh and Khan, two faculty members, not here, but they're professors. Our process, we met with various student groups and in through focus groups, asking questions about where they feel safe, why they don't feel safe, what they feel is in the culture, how they thought that the culture could change, how they thought that the institution could be responsive. We looked at many best practices, not only just public health in general, but also public health around sexual health, healthy relationships, sexual assault. We did some benchmarking with our Ivy and Ivy Plus peers. We also looked at some institutions that are not in the Ivy Plus, but are our size to better understand how they engage in sort of culture change around sexual assault. We had various conversations with leaders on campus, with students, with faculty and staff, with Greek alumni, coaches, athletes, and then a lot of analyzing data, the SARM survey and some other data that we were able to access through some of our original conversations. Next slide.
So we're going to highlight, we have four categories of recommendations, which you've seen in the report. And they fall into these different areas about communication, developing new courses, physical safety, and then programming that occurs outside the classroom. Next slide. So we're just going to highlight one example from each of these recommendations just to provide a little bit of a sense of what we're looking at. So in terms of communication, one of the recommendations that we're making is an interactive decision tree. So something that we heard was, in the moment when an assault occurs, there's often an understandably confusion about what to do or what even the options are of what one could do. And so we're working to develop a decision tree that will guide you through the different options of reporting or not reporting, confidential resources, non-confidential resources, and where those different options lead you. We're working to get those put on the back of student IDs. So in the moment, wherever you happen to be, you or your friend will be able to quickly understand what the resources and options are and how to navigate through them. So that's one example of a recommendation in the area of communication, and you can see some of the other ones here. Next slide. A second area of recommendation that we heard really clearly when we spoke to students was a desire for coursework focused in this area. One of the things that came through in the SARM survey is that 40% of Cornell students have had only abstinence-only sex education before they come here. There's obviously a lot of variety in that. But regardless of that, we heard from students a desire just to better understand not just sort of risks, but some basic concepts, areas of communication, how to think about consent in different ways. So we have a variety of recommendations there around coursework. The one that I'll highlight here is incorporating a module on this in the first year advising classes that most colleges offer for first year, first semester students. We're going to be piloting this in human ecology in the fall and developing ways to roll that out. Logistically challenging, but to roll that out more broadly across the whole campus.
Next slide. We heard a lot about just sort of physical spaces, particularly geography. And so the first two really speak to sort of students, not reluctance, but they're off campus and they're far off campus, and perhaps they'd rather go back to their dorm room, but their reluctance to maybe make the trip because it's cold, they've been drinking, it's far. And so they sort of feel stuck in College Town was sort of one way that a student mentioned it. But one of the other areas is sort of incentivizing REEC organizations to go above and beyond in their party safety measures. We heard from a lot of students, particularly women-identified students, who said, we make a lot of rules for ourselves and our friends when we go to Greek houses, to fraternity houses, and so that we can keep ourselves and each other safe. And when we were talking with fraternities, they were like, wow, these are some things that we're learning. And they're eager and to be in the space of how can we make our homes and our places feel and shift the culture of what students are saying that they're feeling when we have parties at our places. And so there's some momentum about wanting to create a healthy environment and how might we incentivize Greek organizations to take that extra step. Next slide. Last, we heard from a lot of folks that they want more programming, and particularly they felt programming at the beginning of a student's journey right after matriculation and before the beginning of the school year. Not necessarily to get it all in one fell swoop, but rather for there to be an identifiable in-person program that helps to establish what the Cornell expectation is or what the culture is that the student body wants as it relates to healthy relationships, sexual assault, consent, alcohol use. And so finding opportunities in orientation, which we plan to do this coming orientation, to have a new required in-person session, and then reinforce during first year programming out of TACON and in other spaces in residence life and in other areas of campus.
Next slide. Yeah, go ahead.
Representative Galperin,
they do.
thank you guys for being here. Thank you for sharing. You mentioned 42% of the incidents. Can you hear? 42% of the incidents, I think it was, involved penetration or attempted penetration. First of all, let's call that what it is. That's attempted rape. And that's almost half. And it does not, sorry, it does not get to that point on its own. It doesn't just happen suddenly. So what are we actually going to do to hold organizations accountable when these things are happening, in their spaces, in their buildings, to avoid it actually getting to that point?
Yeah, so well, I would love to hear from you. So we agree that that's completely unacceptable and a critical issue. And so these recommendations pertain to that. And I'd love to hear feedback on that. Let me just quickly just talk about what's happening next. So we've written this report. The recommendations have been shared with and embraced by the president and provost. And so we're moving ahead. And so right now we're moving into the implementation phase for all of these. If you go to the next slide, you can see some of the first steps. Oops, maybe that's not there. Some of it takes more time than others. Some things we could do right away are things like the QR code, the new model for orientation. Things that'll take longer involve setting up new classes, developing a group of peer student leaders who can do programming around this. So it'll all be staged according to feasibility, but there's a commitment to do this work. There'll be a website developed where updates will be provided. But we're really here to hear your feedback. So I would love to hear you all discuss those very questions.
Representative Spector.
All right, I have a few things. The first thing I wanted to seek clarification on one of your statistics is it 78% of women who consumed alcohol before the assault happened that were incapacitated or passed out, or 78% of all assaults? Because that was a little confusing.
Of the women who said they had experienced sexual assault, 78% had consumed alcohol.
Thank you. And then, sorry, I wasn't done with my thing, but I have a couple of comments. The first is that you can encourage Greek life organizations to increase their safety all you want, but it doesn't matter when they're the ones who are perpetuating the behavior. You can say, pretty please don't assault people. And if they're the ones doing it, they're going to go, yeah, we definitely won't, and just move on. That's not going to change anything. The other thing is that like students and people in Greek life already know not to assault people. Like that's just like a pretty basic thing that I would hope Cornellians are smart enough to know not to do. So what we really need are harsher punishments and more swift actions towards these organizations that have incidences. I remember there was I think it was a gang rape a few years ago, I want to say. I remember students were terrified and there was not much information, and it felt like it took a while for the university to do anything to, I think the frat was eventually suspended, but it took a little bit. And the other thing is that none of this addresses how you're going to help the people who are already victims. There are, I mean, according to your statistics, half the women on this campus and a good number of the men here are just walking around with trauma that they can't feel that they can report. How are you going to gain the trust of victims so that they feel they can s report this behavior and they can seek help? Thank you.
Thanks for the questions. Let me start backwards, and then I might have to ask you to revisit some of the questions. Part of the recommendations, right? We've given you a high-level overview. We've only talked about one recommendation out of each area. If you read the full report, there's work that communicates what we will do, particularly in the SHARE office and the victims advocacy space. In our processes, we recognize that not many students know about that resource and about the office and the ways that they can access this office. I would say the decision tree also provides some opportunity for us to put resources in front of survivors and their friends, right? If 80% of students are having conversations with their friends, we want to make sure that 80% of friends have 80, 90% of friends have the information to help guide in the process. Our goal and really part of this, our framework was to one, be thoughtful not only about culture change, but that culture change also being trauma-informed and recognizing that survivors are on campus, that there are already people who have experienced the harm that we're trying to change. I think we were really thoughtful in the development of these processes. Our committee included folks from the SHARE office. We partnered with the Coalition on Sexual Violence to also hear from our community partners to hear about what they see as some of the issues that we're having on campus. We met with CAPS counselors to better understand, obviously, them not sharing confidential information or HIPAA protected information, but to get a better sense of the themes of what they're seeing so that we can develop some of these, some resources and recommendations that better guide our one change of culture, but our support of those who've already experienced the harm. I will say that one of the things that happens when you go into a process of a task force and looking at things, right? You saw on an earlier slide sort of why folks don't share this information. What you typically see after you implement some recommendations and you start to get everyone on board with what we're asking the community to engage in and their part and their role in it, you'll see more reports, which doesn't mean that necessarily sexual assault is happening more on campus. It means that there is a belief in the structure and the process and the policies that want to help to support those that are harmed. I think your question was about Greek life. One of the things that I want to just clarify is what we've asked in the SARM survey is if you're Greek affiliated, the responses aren't necessarily related in the sense of that assault took place in a Greek house or by someone in a Greek organization. And so it's hard for us to parse out. And what I don't want to downplay is that sexual violence, I don't want to downplay that sexual violence happens in those spaces and our students are concerned about it and our institution is concerned about it. One of the things that we didn't mention off top is that this wasn't a just professor or your professor too, a Dean Dunafin and I having a conversation saying like, hey, let's stand up a task force. But really this was a push and an initiative and a charge given to us by the president and the provost. They've been really engaged in this process and want to be leaders in the change that we want to see on college campuses. One other area that I would respond to, and you let me know if I haven't, Hayden, right? Yes, you let me know if I haven't answered all of your question. Nope, now I just lost my thought, sorry. Maybe Rachel has something to say.
No, I think that was great. I wanna make sure I hear other people's questions as well.
Representative Elbridge.
All right, so I'm gonna go off what Representative Spector said and maybe go a little further. First of all, just responding to what you said about how people just said if they were affiliated with Greek life, we can't tell if those happen in Greek houses. If there's a confounder in the universe that can make a 23% difference between those two groups happen, I'd love to hear about it. I don't think it exists. I think it's because of Greek life. And personally, I think the fact that you, and by the way, I really like the way you approach this, having a research-driven approach, talking with folks in focus groups, I think is a great way to go about it. The fact that you heard from folks that they have to come up with certain rules for themselves when they go to Greek houses, it's great that you responded to that by talking to these Greek houses about how they can implement some rules to make it so folks don't have to do that. But the truth is that folks have to do that because those spaces have dangerous cultures that cause this violence to occur to people. So frankly, I think if we're not willing to say that one of the problems is Greek life, not that we need to fix Greek life, but that Greek life is the problem, I think we have an issue. And I know Greek life has a lot of influence on this campus, but I would hope we can recognize that. So I guess I'm curious, have you considered ways to combat Greek life's influence and the fact that they are part of the problem? Has there been consideration of, you know, Princeton doesn't recognize fraternities and sororities, for instance, and Cornell does, and they've tried to phase those organizations out. Has there been consideration of that? Because I think that would make people a lot safer.
So I want to say that wasn't part of our charge. And so, like you said, we were using data and insights. I think that but hearing that feedback from you and your perspective is really important. We're in the early stages of this. I think, again, we're taking a sort of holistic public health approach that involves the entire community and is focused on communication and understanding and education. And I think that will affect all aspects of the university culture.
And so maybe this is one of those spaces where we're going to continue to have conversations with students and unpack these things. You don't come up with all of the solutions. We were a committee over a little over a year and a half, but that our process, and as mentioned in what's next, is to continue to engage with students to better understand. I will ask, and this is, you know, a reflective question for all of us, is how do we shift culture if we're the ones living in the culture, right? So this is not saying that the institution doesn't have responsibility, but I think Rachel and I have done this presentation a couple times, and you were talking about it today, where we asked the question, asking and probing, sort of what would it look like if organizations were to say, sororities perhaps, if sororities were to say, we're just not going to these houses, like we want to change where these parties happen. How might that change the culture? How might that set expectation, right? And so some of this is skill building. How do we advocate for each other? How do we also keep each other safe while also recognizing that there are systems that we need to work on? And so a public health approach is also changing of behavior, empowerment, and also changing of structures and policies. One alone is not going to do the work. We're going to have to do that together and multi prongs. And so I think that that's something that we hope to continue to engage with students, right? Like, engage with students. You were saying that they have like sort of a stronghold. How did you say it?
I don't
Max, you
know.
said
Powerful.
there was something that you said that intimated influence, right? How do we change the influence, and how do we change those that they're influencing? And so I'm not sure, were you referring to their influence at an institutional level or their influence at a student level? And I think they're both there, right? And so how do we respond in multiple ways to change, if the perception is that it's influence, how do we change that?
Representative Agarwal.
Also, being able to talk to you, Dean Love, with the focus group earlier this year, it's really cool to see the report come out. So I just want to say thank you. I read through the report and I really actually enjoyed the table at the end where you had kind of each recommendation listed out and like potential feasibility, the timeline, and also whether or not they were already in progress. So I did really enjoy that. I kind of have like, it's like a series of questions, but they all kind of relate to each other. So always feel free to let me know if I need to repeat any of them. The first one is, out of this list of recommendations, because they're just recommendations, is Cornell actually committed to like implementing them, or like which ones are just under consideration? It's my main first question. And then also the, I guess, second question is just how will the university and the administration be held accountable if these recommendations are not implemented? And then my final question is, what specific metrics do you have in place, or is this task force working on to see if these recommendations are successful in like 2 to 3 years?
Thank you so much, and thank you for reading all the way to the end with the table, because I do think that might be even the most important part about is certainly in terms of articulating how we go forward. So the president and provost have received and accepted all of the recommendations. And so that's, again, Marla mentioned, or Dean Love mentioned, how fortunate we are to have the administration, the president and provost, fully behind all of this. And that's very unique and something we can really be proud of at Cornell, to be shining a light on this and putting time and effort into it. And so in terms of accountability, that's critical. And so what we plan to do next is to, and it was on one of those slides that we had to rush through, was to have a website where there's the elements of the recommendations, updates on the timeline, what's been done. And then eventually there is a strong evaluation component to it, which we talked a little bit about in that same table. So some of the things we might see are increased knowledge of how to report, you know, so we have survey data that'll allow us to measure that. We might see engagement in public health, you know, kind of initiatives on campus in terms of attendance. We'll get feedback from classes through the normal channels of feedback, as well as more informal ways, and in terms of like, we'll want to have a student advisory council for all of this and get feedback and ideas from them. So for each of the recommendations, we did articulate how that would be evaluated, and those would be updated on the website for accountability.
Representative Tartiri.
Hi. So it's very similar to Sonia. Also, really appreciate it getting to sit in a working group earlier and talk a little bit about this, and really cool to read the final report. To go back to what Max was talking about a little bit earlier, I would actually offer like a differing viewpoint. Like, as someone like from the Princeton area, at least, I don't think that like Greek life inherently, like getting rid of Greek life inherently, is like be all end all to the solution, just because like at least like from Princeton's standpoint, there's a huge like date rape culture. There's a huge like eating clubs are literally the exact same things as fraternities as far as I'm concerned. So I wouldn't like offering a different perspective on that. But more so, I think something that I've been thinking about a lot, but I haven't seen a ton in like the report, is illicit substances and how that ties into like date rape, or like just rape culture here on campus and things like that, and crackdowns on that. Because I think it's absurd that like that high a percentage of students report that they literally weren't conscious because of like illegal substances. And then also like the takeaway from the report is like, oh, like what do we do about stopping, like to me, like secondary result of like a student like overdosing in the first place. So I wanted to hear if like you guys have had thoughts about, like, in terms of just like drug usage on campus, especially like illegal drug usage on campus, like stuff beyond just like weed.
I think, one of the challenges in this type of work is that there's not very good data collection. So ideal, I mean, there are several universities and colleges that have eliminated Greek life. And in an ideal world, there'd be high enough quality data that you'd be able to measure whether or not that implicated sexual assaults. And we just don't have information on that, but it's not clear that the answer is yes in some of those cases. Same with going back to the data in terms of alcohol, in terms of substance use, the data tell us that it's alcohol that's involved, that's prevalently involved with sexual assaults, but not drugs, just based on how people answered the survey. Whether, that just re requires people to answer the survey truthfully and honestly. But the role of alcohol was really, really prominent. And so throughout, we weren't able to elevate this in our comments, but throughout all of the recommendations, a key part of the education and the programming and the conversations will have to be, what does consent look like when there's alcohol involved? Like, what does that really look like? Kind of in real time, and what's the role of alcohol in thinking about your own sexual citizenship, what you want, that of others, how to enact that. Those are the kind of conversations we have to incorporate into this.
Representative Tarala.
Thank you both for being here. I mean, this is clearly very an important topic. And I'm glad that we're discussing it. On the University Assembly, we also hear from our representative there as well. And it's good to, I think, hear the results of the committee and the research that's being done. I just wanted to bring up recently I visited some friends at other colleges. There were some other, like one for example was Tufts University, and they have this Green Dot program. I just did like 30 seconds of research. It's apparently like a really, really big deal there. I don't know if it's something that you guys have heard of before, but apparently it's the only intervention program recognized by the CDC as effective in increasing active bystander behaviors. I mean, I'm not saying Tufts is maybe the perfect example, but like it definitely, I think we should be looking, at these peer institutions, at what they're doing. I mean, at least speaking to my friends at these colleges, like they speak very highly of these programs, and it's a very like strong presence on campus. So yeah, just something to consider, I suppose.
And I would say that this was like particularly in the conversation we had with Sonia and the group that she brought together in a focus group, we talked about several of these sorts of programs. For those of you that aren't familiar, Green Dot is a bystander intervention program. It starts by training influencers in the spaces that they're influencing. And so you take a look at your student body and you say, okay, there are these influencers in Greek life. There are influencers that are in the a cappella groups. There's the influencers and leaders that are in the STEM fields. You bring them together to become basically, you train them in this bystander intervention and use them to train other students. This idea that like a green dot touches another green dot, another green dot, another green dot, and now you've expanded on the map those that have the skills to intervene in situations. Because they have the knowledge to understand, hey, this person is not in a position where they can consent, or they're not in a position, or they're in a position that like is becoming increasingly hostile or dangerous, or they're being isolated, and someone steps in and changes the behavior there. So that's a bit about Green Dot, and I think that there have been conversations about what are those programs that we engage in. I was a part of a community when I worked at the Claremont Colleges that brought Green Dot to those campuses, and but modif not modified it, but you adapt it to your university size, your university culture, your university needs. And so a lot of our efforts have been how do we find programs that meet sort of the size of our institution that will have impact and will hit not just student leaders in certain spaces, but hit students in other spaces, because we recognize that students are experiencing sexual assault and violence, not just in one aspect of life, but in multiple aspects of life. A lot of the research around college sexual assault is 1 in 4 women-identified students will experience sexual assault. Truthfully, they that's of those that we know that report it. the research really talks that it's more like 1 in 3, and for men, 1 in 8, but really more like 1 in 5. And so, how do we navigate that as an institution to make sure that we're getting to all spaces and all students to think about the ways in which we all are part of the culture change that needs to happen?
Representative Massoud.
Thank you guys so much for, doing all this work. I think it's really important, obviously. I wanted to actually touch back on your earlier question on illicit substances. The way that I understood that question was more about like the concept of roofying. I think that like people are gonna report like alcohol, people are gonna report that they drank, but a lot of people who are in situations like this end up being slipped something that they didn't intentionally take. It's not, so they wouldn't be reporting that they use drugs, so I guess like how do you guys navigate that, and how do you crack down on the use of like roofies at, Greek life? And
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's terrible. And so that kind of gets to the bigger picture should be like, what is it? Why is it that people don't understand that? That that's a horrible and wrong thing to do. Part of that's individual behavior that needs to be addressed and brought through our appropriate systems. But if there the culture and sort of community component of that is there's something going on where that the register of thinking through how wrong that is and what that means for the people around us and our community isn't coming through somehow. We need to think about that. It didn't come up in a lot of our conversations and focus groups in terms of I don't be, based on the conversations and data we have, I don't believe that's the normative instance in which sexual assaults occur. But it's obviously something critical that I hope with all this other focus on community and understanding and pe forcing people to really think about, not forcing, but helping people think about what it means to be here together and parts of our healthy community that would certainly be addressed by that too.
we only have time for two more questions, so anyone with any more questions or comments, please raise Packard. Representative, I'm sorry, I can't see your last name, Amelia. Thank you.
Again, I'd like to echo everyone else's sentiments. Thank you so much for coming here and doing this important research and work. Like, I'm new to the assembly as of 2 meetings ago, and I see the amount of work you guys have put into creating this research and the amount of student feedback that you've also put in there. So I find that very important and interesting. Now, I'm coming in here as a report, as like a recommendation or a question about recommendation 4, which is the non-classroom programming you have here. And from my understanding, it sounds like you want to try to put programming into the orientation first year experience, which I think that sounds really great. But coming from a freshman perspective, I think that a big problem that I saw in my experience is that this participation problem, and we see it here in assembly, we see it everywhere on campus, the fact that the orientation leader leaders, faculty, and students, incoming students, and existing students both don't really have it in them to put forward good programming and stuff that like matters and makes sense. How are you planning to ensure that this sexual assault training and programming, which is very important, it's important to me, but it might not be important to other people or incoming students. Some people might just not show up. Why is this important to me? What's your plan for addressing that sort of non-participation?
Yeah, great question. Again, this is where like we want to hear from you for the most part. So this is where you all can help guide us. That's critical. I think that it would be mandatory. So there's mandatory components of orientation. So that's what we're talking about. There's some models out there of places. I think Stanford, for example, has a really robust model of incorporating this in very meaningful ways, not just a lecture of being delivered material, but sort of substantive discussion groups around it at orientation. That's what we want to move toward. It's hard because of our size. And so we're also looking at other places that are the same size as us and thinking about how could we, it's one thing to deliver the information, which I think is critical, and we're going to be doing that. And then the second level would be to have like peer-led orientation leader type groups where you can actually talk about it. And so I think we can do that. I think we can motivate around that and do that. We do that in other ways, but that takes a lot of skill building. We need to get the right expertise on this campus and then logistically figure it out. But that's the goal.
I think the other thing that I would add is, again, And it'll feel like sort of broken drum or whatever. This Rachel and I are in, like, we're representing the task force and the work that we did. But ultimately, for recommendations to be successful, we need to be partnering together. There's going to be some program creation, but also I think how do students continue to say, and this is the part of sexual citizenship, this is what we value in our community, and this is what we expect of each other. And if the expectations are not being met, then we will change our engagement. We will change our support, whether that's financial or participation and engagement. And that's also going to have to be a part of this process. And so it is sort of being an influencer to say, hey, I think not only in the orientation, but in the programs that we hope to have for all students across class years, to say this is an important value for us. And the last thing that I would say is, as a person that sits in my role, this is also about what does it mean to be a developing adult and to make some decisions, right? To empower yourselves and empower others to speak up and to act. And so a lot of this is calling all of us into action on something that we have found to be horrific, to be violent, to be power-based violence, to say that this no longer is something that we stand in our community and not just say it, but also then say, and I want to be a part of the change. And that doesn't necessarily mean a resolution. It might also mean, like, I'm going to attend these events and I'm going to bring four people from an organization that has nothing to do with gender equity or sexual assault or violence, and say, I want us all to be in a place that, like, when and where we need to use these skills, we'll use them. And so the culture is not just administrators, it's also students, and it's student leaders, and it's also just students who are on this campus who say, this is what I want in a community that I am spending time, that I value, that I want to develop in. And so if there's any call from this, it is when we look at what this recommendation is, and I think your question, Sonia, was like, how will we hold the university accountable to meeting these recommendations? It's also how will you hold yourselves accountable to being a part of the change that we're looking for, right?